Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Wow, it's been kind of a while since I've been able to do a podcast. I was on holiday for 2 weeks with my family in New Mexico, visiting family there. And then when I got back, it's sort of the time of year when a lot of editors are going on holiday. And a lot of people are submitting papers, I think, before the semester starts. So we have high submissions and then limited editorial availability. And so we're all trying to cover for each other's papers to a certain degree. And I just got buried trying to catch up at work a little bit. So it took me quite a while to get going back in the podcast. Sorry about that. But I was able to finally schedule an interview with Rob DeCanto from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. I've known Rob for a few years, mostly through the usual course of business of Rob's submissions to Nature, reviewing, and then seeing Rob at a few meetings over the years, and have always been interested in the range of his ideas on things like the thresholds for the initiation of glaciation in Antarctica and the Northern Hemisphere, insights into what might be driving the abrupt warming at the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, and then also in a wide range of topics on modeling of the Antarctic ice sheet and trying to produce models that are a hybrid between relatively simple parameterizations of ice dynamics and the really complicated Full-Stokes models that are still, for the most part, too computationally expensive to run for long transient simulations. Rob and I talk a lot about how that kind of modeling came to pass, particularly through his ongoing collaboration with David Pollard. And in the course of me pestering Rob about how this collaboration really works, he tells me the kind of long story about how their current model, which includes a hydrofracturing mechanism, came to be and how it really relied on, and first of all, kind of going down a dead alley scientifically, but then through having the right people in the audience at the right time, a series of ideas coming together to produce this mechanism of surface melt leading to hydrofracturing, which in turn causes runaway ice cliff failure. And finally, that can lead the model to simulate the kinds of sea level rise that we think happen during times like the mid-Pliocene warm period. On my end, besides coming back from vacation and being buried at work, I'll be going to the CLIVAR meeting in Qingdao, China in mid-September, and then doing a Nature Masterclass, which is basically a writing workshop about how to write papers for high-impact journals. So if you or your colleagues or your lab have an interest in that kind of thing, you can check out the Nature Masterclasses as well. And then I'm staying on for a short Global Ocean Summit run by one of my previous podcast guests, Lixin Wu. Over the longer term, I'm hoping to be able to attend the Urbino Summer School on Paleoclimatology. Rob mentioned that to me, and I discussed it with Jim Zakos and Yair Rosenthal in the past, and it sounds like just an amazing opportunity. It's a two-week summer school in Urbino, so that's just to the east of Florence, kind of on the mid-eastern coast of Italy. And they bring in this astonishing range of the best people in paleoclimatology, and then a pretty big range of PhD students and postdocs, and it sounds like a wonderful opportunity. The timing for this interview is great because Rob just won the Tinker Muse Prize for Science and Policy in Antarctica. This is, practically speaking, the biggest award that's given out for Antarctic science, won by Valerie Maison-Delmotte, one of my other podcast guests the previous year, and Tim Nash the year before that. So a huge honor for Rob. He just gave the keynote speech a couple of days ago in Malaysia at the SCAR meeting. Unfortunately, as is so often the case for me, I've done something wrong technically. This time I had a new laptop and didn't set the recording to go in the uncompressed WAV format. Instead, it was done in MP3. So the audio quality is not great. Sorry about that, but at least it is fully understandable. Thanks for listening. And again, sorry for the long delay in podcasts. Hopefully I'll be back on a more regular schedule soon. Thanks for listening. Rob DeCanto from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Thanks for coming on the show today, Rob.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
You were born in Boston. It sounds like you spent most of your early years in the East Coast. How did you find Boston as a child?
You know, it's funny. I couldn't wait to leave the East Coast and move out west after high school, and was infatuated with the mountains and the idea of of the West in Colorado, which is where I ended up going to college. You know, I had a really happy life in Boulder for a lot of years, and it was a little bit of a surprise that my wife shares a similar story. Hers is more New York focused. We met in Colorado. And, you know, now that we've been back on the East Coast for 16, 17 years, we're really happy to be back in the Northeast.
Were there particular things that you felt like you needed to escape, or was it just the common experience that kids have? They want to leave wherever it was that they grew up.
Yeah, I think it's that. Just, I think, you know, the sense of adventure for some Northeast kids, the big wide open spaces of the West was appealing. And I had gotten into outdoor sports in high school. I was skiing and rock climbing and doing that kind of thing. So it was really appealing. And now I'm really happy to be close to the ocean again, to tell you the truth.
You went to high school at a prep school in Maine. Was that a rural area of Maine where you did have access to that kind of outdoor activity?
Yeah, absolutely. Very rural, just over the New Hampshire border, on the edge of the White Mountains. Really great place and a really nice school in that there was a mix of both students from really all over the world. It was international. And at the same time, locals were allowed to go to the school. So I had just a really great mix of friends. It was a great experience.
Did a lot of your friends from, let's say, your grade school and middle school days also go off to private prep schools? Was that a common experience?
You know, no. And I have to admit that I've been really, I don't do Facebook. I don't have a Facebook account. I've lost touch with just about everybody at this point. It's kind of funny. You know, I think a lot of people did go off to school, and I would say not so much out to the West.
At the time then, it felt as though you were doing something a bit unusual and going off to Colorado for school.
Yeah, I think that's true. And in fact, yeah, I remember, I wouldn't say resentment or maybe a little jealousy, but I remember feeling a little bit funny when I would go from Colorado and I would return to New England and visit with people. You know, it seemed like a lot of my high school crew were staying pretty close to home. And that might be part of, you know, why I just sort of ended up losing touch and not staying as connected to a lot of those people.
Do you mean that it all felt just a bit kind of provincial when you came back, or was it something else?
You know, really great question. I haven't really, it's funny that you're asking me these questions because I haven't really reflected on them for a really, really long time. I have some vague memories of like going to parties where some of my, you know, ex-high school classmates were at, and this is after I had gone away to college, and almost being sort of poked fun at a little bit and just being made to feel as though I was a bit of an outsider now for having done that, for having left.
Were your parents encouraging of you going off to the prep school, or was that something that you wanted to do when you were, let's say, 14 years old?
They were encouraging. My parents had semi-retired to the Cape. My mother was still working and my dad was working some. I was on Cape Cod for a while, doing great initially in school, and then just, I don't know, I was struggling.
You mean academically or?
Not really, more personally. My home life wasn't great, and it just seemed like a really good opportunity, and it seemed like the right time to break away and try something new. And it was really fantastic, absolutely the best thing I ever could have done. In fact, we weren't financially very well off. Being a boarded student at this school really wasn't an option for me. So my sister was working in the ski industry and living in North Conway, New Hampshire, which is a big outdoor, you know, ski resort town, and there's a big rock climbing community there. So she took me in, and I was able to be a day student at this really great small prep school, and it was fantastic, and it totally set me up for college.
It sounds like then you were kind of a hybrid student with still some family ties and supervision, but also a lot more freedom than you would have had if you'd stayed with your parents in Cape Cod.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. My sister is 12 years older than I am, but, you know, she was still young enough at the time and doing her own thing. So I did. I had a lot of freedom, but it worked somehow. I really actually buckled down. It's funny. I was given the freedom and the opportunity and really found my self-motivation and discipline.
Did you find an interest in science growing at that time when you were in school in Maine, or did that come later?
No, actually, I always had that. you know, like my favorite, I'd go to the library and like, and I'm really not just saying this, but I would just, I was really captivated by books on like geology and volcanoes and oceanography and marine biology. I always had that spark. I wouldn't have known until I went away to high school how you would even start to go down the road to be able to have a career in studying those systems. And even in Colorado, actually, I surfed around a little bit in terms of finding the right major, but I ended up in the earth sciences. And yep, the rest was, well, it's history now.
Did you go out to the University of Colorado at Boulder for your bachelor's degree primarily because of the outdoor recreation opportunities?
It was definitely a big part of the draw. And like I said, so in high school I had started getting really into outdoor sports, and Boulder was already becoming sort of ground zero for that. It ended up being a great place to go to school, a lot of opportunities there. I met a lot of great people. The university was growing programs in atmosphere and ocean science, as well as having, you know, a long-standing great reputation in geology and earth science and geophysics. So, it ended up just being fantastic, just the right combination of everything.
At what point during your undergraduate time did you begin to realize that Boulder supported not only the university environment, but also the NOAA and NCAR labs that make the whole area this amazing nexus of geoscience research?
It wasn't long, actually, particularly with NCAR, because it has such a prominent place in the city. That IMP building, it's almost like a temple. And it was to me then, you know, in college. It's funny, you know, I thought, God, it would have been a dream to someday work in that lab. I never imagined that that would end up happening, and it did. So, yeah, I was very aware of what was there. You can't miss it. The labs are all over the city. They're big. You meet a lot of people. And I remember meeting undergrads in college who had grown up in Boulder and whose parents, father and mother, were scientists at those labs, whether it was NIST or NOAA or NCAR. So, yep, pervasive. Now Boulder feels a little funny to me in that it's become so expensive and in some ways exclusive, and with Google and, you know, back then it was Sun Microsystems. A lot of the people who sort of founded Boulder as just an amazing community are no longer even able to afford to live in the city and downtown and so forth. So Boulder feels a little bit different to me that way.
I just saw that Boulder is now the fifth most expensive area in the U.S. for housing.
Wow. Wow.
Of course, where I live is number two. So
yeah.
Boulder would be cheap in comparison. So you majored in earth science at UC Boulder, mm-hmm. UC Colorado at Boulder, got out in 1986, I believe, but then stayed on at Boulder and NCAR for your PhD and also for postdocs. Did you ever seriously debate going somewhere else, or was it just such a clearly great choice to stay?
I was really lucky in terms of funding and fellowships and that kind of thing. So I was set up. I knew I was going to have a mostly paid for degree. You know, once I got my foot in the door at NCAR, I wasn't going to budge.
How do PhDs work when you're at NCAR? I mean, I know people who have done this, and it's never been entirely clear. You have to be advised by somebody at UC,
yep.
But then you're sort of doing most of your work actually at NCAR.
That's exactly right. So your actual degree, as it's confirmed on your diploma, you know, would read University of Colorado at Boulder. At least back then, your technical title would be a visiting scientist at NCAR. And yeah, that's basically how it works.
And you worked with people like Starley Thompson and Warren Washington at NCAR. What was your experience like working with those kind of really pioneering modelers and climate scientists?
Warren was and still is an incredible sage, basically. It's interesting. I had an interest in Earth history, and Stephen Schneider, who I think founded the group that Starley was running that I was embedded in, Stephen Schneider had a real appreciation for past climate and what it might be able to tell us about the future. And Starley also was a really, really creative scientist as well as, you know, a great meteorologist and modeler. So I was not only at NCAR, which was fantastic, but I was surrounded by the best people in the world. And it happened to be that there was a real spirit of creativity and freedom in my group at the time, it was a golden era, at least in terms of interdisciplinary science at NCAR.
When I look at the work you've done over the years, what's always struck me is that you have this interest in the deep time topics, but also future climate. And it sounds like that interest across a range of timescales grew out of your early experiences in the PhD.
That's exactly right. And the person who first introduced me to climate models and the emergence of GCMs, which were beginning to become really pretty usable tools, was a professor at Colorado, just one of the most brilliant and I think underappreciated American geoscientists, somebody by the name of William Hay, Bill Hay, H-A-Y. Bill actually just published a pretty remarkable second edition of a book called Experimenting on a Small Planet. And yeah, it's really super, really wonderful. A lot of anecdotal stories about the emergence of the science of climate change. And Bill was one of the co-founders of the ocean drilling program. Bill knew that GCMs and climate modeling, that these were tools that could be used, you know, not just for studying the modern system in the future, but also a geological tool, in essence. And it was, I think it was Bill's inspiration that actually originally set Eric Barron up with Warren Washington at NCAR way back. You know, Eric went on to great things pioneering climate modeling of the Cretaceous era. A lot of that inspiration comes from Bill Hay, and I think a lot of people don't know that or appreciate that. And so it was Bill's original spark. Yeah, and then having this opportunity at NCAR, and at that time, you know, I was working in the spirit of some of the things that I knew that Bill was interested in, and then Bill ended up leaving Colorado. He took on a half-time appointment, and I think he was running the paleoceanography program at Geomar in Kiel, Germany. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of left behind in Boulder, but set up at NCAR, and again, an opportunity where I had really complete freedom. It ended up working out really well.
Having this complete freedom, what were the ideas that initially drove your work forward?
So back then, we were really still trying to, and this is still something that hasn't been really completely sorted out in the community, but it was trying to reconcile the notion of past climates warmer than today that had very, very low difference in temperature between the tropics and the polar regions. So these reduced temperature gradients. And you've published many papers on the topic. It's still widely debated. This is still an ongoing, long-standing problem in the science. Interesting. So, you know, we were looking at these ancient climates, but it was really to understand the dynamical processes that could create a world like that. I've bounced all over the geological timescale, and it's because, you know, I'm looking to the geological record for some guidance in really trying to understand the system, not trying to use an understanding of the system to try to say something about these past times. So I've always had it sort of flipped the other way around, and it's served me well. You know, I've worked on things from the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum now to looking at the potential for future sea level rise. So it's been a really fantastic, fun ride.
Getting back for just a moment to this equitable climate dilemma, you're talking about the fact that the geological evidence suggests that during past warm periods, the gradient in temperatures between the polar regions and the equators was much lower than it is now. So much warmer polar areas. We have like the A6 course, for example, sort of quasi-tropical vegetation in both of the poles, and that the climate models have a difficult time getting this gradient the same way that you have in the proxies. Is that approximately correct?
That's basically it. That is the story. And you can reproduce a climate that fits these climate proxy reconstructions of what the world might have looked like, whether it's the Cretaceous or the Eocene. But people who have been pretty successful in doing that have had to resort to things like cranking up the greenhouse gas concentrations to really pretty outrageous levels, higher than most geochemists would tell you was possible at that time.
Like several thousand ppm?
Yeah, that kind of thing. There have been some really promising new ideas regarding clouds as a potential mechanism to drive pretty extraordinary polar warmth. I think that's sort of where that community stands now. It looks to me, you know, based on talks I've seen and the work of people like Matt Huber and Jeff Keel at NCAR, and some of these cloud ideas were sparked by a really clever geochemist. Back when I was in the game, there had been some work trying to reconcile those really reduced equator to polar temperature differences with changes in ocean circulation and the transport of heat by the oceans. But that hasn't played out in physical models. That's been so far essentially impossible to justify. So there must be something else going on. And of course, the implications are, like so many things, when we try to replicate what the Earth has looked like in the past, we find that if anything, the models too often don't capture the full range of, you know, of what the Earth can do on its own. And, you know, when you think about, okay, climate sensitivity and where we want to use these models to predict the future in a warmer world, we might be missing some really critical underlying physics or processes.
You mentioned the possibility that our inability to predict the kind of big changes you see in the geochemical record may indicate missing physical processes. But from what I understand with model development, as you bring in more physical processes, you tend to get more offsetting effects in models, and you actually increase the stability of the models rather than making them more able to do the kind of abrupt changes that we know happen in the system. Do you see a tension there between adding more mechanism to get these processes in there, but then simultaneously making the models too stable?
Funny that you mentioned that, because there was some discussion here at the meeting I'm at right now in Geneva on those sorts of issues. There's always a temptation to keep adding processes to these models. The model systems now are so complex and complicated that, you know, there are very few people in the world now that will understand maybe everything that's going on within one single model. It's almost like we're studying the natural system when we study the results from these models now. As aerosols is a good example, you know, so as climate models started accounting for the effects of aerosols in the atmosphere, not just the direct radiative effects of aerosols, but like their indirect effects by affecting clouds and cloudiness. And there started to be a growing spread in what models were saying about the same future sort of scenario. There's the issue of maybe in some models quieting them down in their potential to be reactive to different forcings. And then there's the issue of now having this really pretty big spread in what some of the models will say about a standard future simulation, for example.
You mentioned how your interest in the paleo record is essentially how that geochemical evidence can inform your process understanding. When I think about the kind of work you've done, you mentioned things like the Eocene Oligocene transition, the Paleocene, the Eocene thermal maximum, but also heavily looking at the Antarctic ice sheet. I'm struck by the fact that you have this broad range of interests. When you are looking at the geochemical record and your interest in processes and physical mechanisms, where do the ideas emerge that seem worth pursuing to you? Do they come out of collaboration discussion with other scientists, or are they coming mostly out of you looking at the geochemical record and just having a spark of an idea coming out?
I've been really fortunate for the now more than a decade. I've been an instructor at the Urbino Summer School for Paleoclimatology, and I usually teach the segments on polar climate and ice sheets and ice sheet ocean interactions, that kind of thing. But many of the instructors at the Urbino Summer School are geochemists and paleoclimatologists and paleoceanographers who developed the techniques to reconstruct Earth climate and Earth oceans in the past. And so I'm lucky enough to, you know, be sitting in the audience with the mostly graduate students and postdocs listening to these wonderful lectures. And the work I've done on the PETM is a great example of being educated about a time period, an interval, an event that I previously really didn't know anything about. And, you know, the instructors were talking about this as potentially being triggered by some change in potentially a change in the oceans, that a warming, for example, that might have triggered the release of stored methane gas into the atmosphere is a potential cause of this really dramatic global warming event that happened about 55 million years ago. Very sudden, probably the closest analog to the current experiment of adding greenhouse gas to the atmosphere. And by the way, still quite a bit slower than what we're doing right now with the release of fossil fuel. But I was struck that one thing that I thought that the earth scientists who were studying that problem weren't thinking about, it started with Antarctica. So I had already been working on Antarctica, the Antarctic ice sheet. I was getting involved in ice sheet modeling, and that was really where my passion was beginning to head. So I really firmly had Antarctica as a continent, you know, in the back of my mind. In some of the early work that we did on Antarctica with ice sheets and ice sheet modeling was trying to see if we could get the models to grow the initial ice sheet.
So the ice sheet formed at about 32 million years ago, and the PETM was in sort of, I think, 55 million years. So
that's right. This is long before the first real big ice sheet formed on Antarctica. That's right.
So essentially an ice-free world.
It would have been an ice-free world. Antarctica was sitting essentially in the same position it sits today. It was centered on the South Pole, more or less. So we had a huge polar continent covered by sure, rock and bare rock, but vegetation as well. And if you think about, you know, those sorts of high latitudes, polar latitudes today that aren't cold enough to have ice sheets, in some areas you find permafrost, and places that have permafrost with vegetation sitting on the surface above the permafrost, those places end up being really great places to store organic carbon. Sort of, you know, being exposed to these records and learning about these events in the past. And then maybe, you know, I think sometimes when you're so close to something, it's easier for somebody to come in from the outside with a fresh perspective because they don't know any better. We, you know, had an idea that, well, you know, maybe we're missing something, and it's not just about the ocean, because there's a big continent sitting on the South Pole and it was probably covered by vegetation. And the other thing that struck me about the PETM was that event happens during a very gradual warming event over millions and millions of years. The Earth was sort of on a background warming trajectory, and it's on that gradual warming climb, warming trajectory that event is triggered. And so it always felt to me like, oh, you know, this looks like it could be a threshold event. So we crossed some threshold that might have kicked in some sort of feedback. We know that the carbon cycle is somehow involved because the geochemists can clearly see that in the geological record.
From the C13 record.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so we were able to support through modeling the notion that, hey, you know, this event could have been caused at least in part by changes in the terrestrial biosphere and the terrestrial carbon cycle. It might not just have been about the ocean. Maybe they were both involved, and they likely were somehow, but that Antarctica was somehow important to that story. It was fun to make a contribution to that community that was studying that really interesting global warming event as a sort of complete outsider.
Yeah.
And really, it's because of the opportunities of Urbino and the really wonderful and brilliant people that I've met there, the other instructors, and the students, too.
You mentioned the idea of a transition or a threshold taking place for the PETM, but the idea of thresholds appears in a lot of your work. When you're looking at your work on the Eocene Oligocene transition, you showed or simulated that there's a CO2 threshold below which an ice sheet will grow. In your more recent work on ice sheets, you're showing that there are transitions from effects like hydrofracturing that can cause runaway ice sheet retreats. The idea of this kind of a threshold in the physical Earth system seems almost inevitable. You have these incredible non-linearities. Did you know that when you got into the field, or is this like a theme and an idea that just sort of developed over the years for you?
It's developed over the years, yeah. I hadn't really thought about where it all came from, and really wasn't, in most cases, expecting to see such dramatic nonlinear jumps in these systems that have come out of the models, and then lo and behold, they look a lot like the records that you see. So I would say it's developed over time, and I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't trying to make the models do this, these kinds of things. It's just the way that it's played out.
just an emergent behavior of the modeling that you've been doing.
That's right.
One of the persistent features of your work has also been the collaboration with David Pollard at Penn State. Can you talk about how you met David and how the collaboration initiated and has persisted for so long and so fruitfully?
Well, that was, you know, in retrospect, maybe the greatest thing that happened to me at NCAR was David Pollard was working in my group. He had been brought into Starley Thompson's group to do some code development. And Dave had been outside of science for a few years. He was working in industry as a programmer, as a code developer. Starley brought him back into the fold. And at the time, Dave was mostly doing GCM model development. But from earlier years, before he had left science for a little while, he had published several really important papers on studying the Northern Hemisphere glacial cycles. And he was coupling, at the time, very simple climate models with very simple ice sheet models and turned out to be a pioneer in that. So Dave, sort of on a side, he started getting back into it, even though he was working on his main task was working on atmospheric stuff at NCAR. And I, you know, was basically a kid at the time, graduate student, and because I was using some of the modeling tools that Dave had been working on development-wise, you know, Dave became my go-to guy and my main mentor in terms of the modeling itself. It was through Dave and our growing friendship and just hanging out that I first started learning about and could see the potential of this emerging field of ice sheet modeling and became really interested in the cryosphere. And it was the introduction from Dave as to what the ice sheets were, how the basics of their physics that started this, you know, what has now turned into a long-standing collaboration. So after I finished my PhD, at around the time I think I had maybe started my first or second postdoc, still in Boulder, Dave left NCAR to take on a research position at Penn State. So Dave left for the East Coast before I did, but we stayed in touch, and it turned out that I found myself maybe within a year on the East Coast too. And so just through email and some phone calls, we thought, you know, hey, some of these ideas that we started talking about at NCAR, you know, we should write a proposal together. And so one of the first proposals I wrote during that transition time, moving from NCAR to University of Massachusetts, was a proposal with Dave to develop and expand on a model that we had started developing before Dave had left for Penn State, an ice sheet model, and to apply it to this problem of let's see if we can grow the ice sheet on Antarctica across the Eocene-Oligocene transition as the Earth is cooling. The rest is history. We've basically been funded by NSF ever since. We've had this just sort of really great collaborative ongoing relationship, friendship. It's been just really a lot of fun.
I think in any kind of successful long-term partnership, first of all, it has to be fun. And it sounds like it's been a lot of fun. But I also think that both parties have to bring something to the table that the other one doesn't have. You've talked about what David brings to the table, but what do you think that you contribute to the partnership that David finds to be useful and helpful and stimulating?
Wow, that's a really great question, and a difficult one. You know, everybody has their sort of own flavor of creativity. You know, Dave and my brain both work really differently, and so we've each been able to bring things, I think, to every one of these stories we've worked on together that have been unique. And we wouldn't have gotten to the final outcome without each of our contribution. So one general problem that we have had, and this goes to this issue of models often not being capable or sensitive enough, capable of simulating some of the changes that we see in the past, we had been sort of beating our head against a wall for years in trying to understand what some of the geologists were telling us in terms of past sea level change. So in the geologic past, whether it was the Miocene 15 million years ago or the Pliocene 5 to maybe 3 million years ago, there appears to be really pretty remarkable sea level variability. I'm mainly, you know, talking about sea levels that are higher than today's sea level, which means that Greenland and or the Antarctic ice sheet have been smaller in the past, and even in the not so distant geologic past. And, you know, we for years, even though our ice sheet and climate models were becoming more and more sophisticated and capable of doing a really nice job of simulating the modern ice sheet, both on Greenland and Antarctica, we just weren't able to simulate the range of variability in those ice sheets that, you know, is implied by the geologic record.
And this is even having things like the marine ice sheet and stability mechanism.
That's right. So that was giving us, for example, for the West Antarctic ice sheet, it was producing a retreating and readvancing and retreating and readvancing Antarctic ice sheet. But we still were only getting maybe 5 or 6 meters of sea level rise out of the Antarctic ice sheet during times as warm as the Pliocene. There are a lot of hints from the geologic record that sea level was much higher than that, maybe as much as 20 or more meters higher than today. So even if you assume that most of the Greenland ice sheet melted during the warmest times in the Pliocene, and then, you know, make the leap that at the same time that Greenland was a lot smaller, that Antarctica also became smaller, as small as we were able to simulate, the numbers still don't add up.
We have like 7 from Greenland, maybe 5 from the West Antarctic, and then maybe a few from land-based peripheral glaciers and ice sheets. So you're still only up to maybe 15.
That's right. So you'd be in sort of that kind of range. You know, so we just kept thinking, gosh, you know, maybe there's just something really fundamental that we're missing in the physics. I somehow had it in the back of my mind that the answer must lie in surface melt. There was more and more work being done on the potential for a warmer ocean to attack the Antarctic ice sheet in places where the ice sheet is in contact with the ocean by melting from the bottom up, from the ocean, the underside of the ice sheet.
So the idea that circumpolar deep water could be coming up onto the shelf and coming up through submarine canyons and destabilizing the grounding line.
That's right. So we had, you know, the physics that account for those effects now in our latest generation of models. And yes, those effects would make the ice sheet retreat. We just couldn't still get enough retreat out of the ice sheet. Surface melt. I sort of had it in the back of my mind that it has to be something to do with surface melt. So we started, you know, working on, okay, well, what could surface melt bring to this? Because the Pliocene, from the modeling that we were doing on the atmospheric side of things, and this is here, you know, this is where we're lucky that we have these tools at our disposal now. We were doing atmospheric modeling of the Antarctic ice sheet in pretty high resolution detail too. And when you get back into the Pliocene, CO2, greenhouse gas concentration similar to today, but the addition of an orbit, a change in the Earth's orbit that would make the summers in Antarctica especially warm, you know, we recognize, wow, you know, in January and February, Antarctica's summer, in the Pliocene, we would have had periods, given the right orbit, where you would have had extensive surface melt on top of the ice shelves and in the ice sheet itself. And so maybe that has something to do with this. So we started thinking, okay, well, what could the surface melt do? The first road we went down was, and I remember giving this talk at EGU in Vienna. And, you know, I said, this is the work that we're doing on the Pliocene. These are our new high-resolution atmospheric simulations, and we can see that there's, during some of these orbits, there's extensive surface melt, and maybe that's the answer. And then I went on to show that even if we assumed that a lot of that surface melt water were to get down to the bed of the ice sheet, what we were doing was where places where the meltwater was forming at the surface, we assume some of it is getting down through the ice sheet to the bed.
Through melanes or some way.
Right, exactly. And so the models track water through the ice sheets. And so we can actually figure out how much liquid water is being produced in every little grid cell of our ice sheet model at the bed. And so what we were doing was just making the bed super slippery in those places. So anytime you'd have a lot of meltwater, we would crank up the slipperiness, make it really, really slippery, which would let the ice slide. And
but at the same time, I think there was work coming out of Greenland to suggest that increased basal lubrication, both from a modeling and observational point of view, didn't necessarily result in sort of big annual speed-ups.
That's right. So it was right about really great. So right about that time, it had been a little bit controversial. The community was going in the direction of this doesn't really work because you have a lot of meltwater at the bed of the ice sheet. It's going to have its biggest effect if you were to think of it as being spread out or distributed under the entire ice sheet, like a film of water, versus being very concentrated in channels, in channelized flow. So, individual channels that focus the flow of water aren't going to be able to have a big effect on the slipperiness. So I was ignoring all of that and saying, like, what if they're wrong? Oh boy. So, ignoring that literature, we still went forward and were cranking up the slipperiness of an ice sheet that had a lot of liquid meltwater on its surface. And it didn't work.
Huh.
Still couldn't get the Pliocene. And so I remember giving this talk and basically throwing up my hands. We're pretty much at wit's end as to what could be driving this kind of sea level variability in a world that isn't really all that much warmer than the modern world. And it was at that meeting, Dave was reflecting on what Richard Alley, I think, had been reminding him of at Penn State. So Richard Alley is a colleague of Dave's at Penn State, and Richard had been thinking in the back of his mind about cliffs. So Richard just, being so experienced in the field, and this is where getting out in the field and in the natural environment is so important, even for a modeler, which is why, I've done some field work in Antarctica, and I'm going to certainly try to get down there more. Is really important is, Richard was just thinking about all the places that he sees ice flowing into the ocean, forming a cliff, a vertical cliff. Cliffs are interesting because ice is only so strong, and we know something about the basic physical properties of ice, how tough it is, its strength, its yield strength. And if you have a thick enough piece of ice, it could potentially break under its own weight. And there are a few places around the world, and Richard Alley has probably seen all of them, just a few places, where these vertical ice cliffs exist that are so tall that the ice can't hold itself together, and those ice cliffs are physically collapsing today. They're breaking. One example in West Greenland would be the Jakobshavn Glacier, where it hits the ocean. In its fjord, it's probably about 1,000 meters of water depth in that fjord, which means that the vertical ice cliff is about 100 meters tall. There are just a few other around the world, the Helheim Glacier in East Greenland and the Crane Glacier on the Antarctic Peninsula are places where today you have very, very thick ice reaching the ocean with no ice shelf out in front of it. And so you have a vertical, unprotected cliff face tall enough that should just break. And at around the same time, we saw a really interesting paper by Jeremy Basis. And Jeremy did just a very simple kind of straightforward calculation on how tall, theoretically, an ice cliff could be given the strength of the ice itself.
Mm-hmm.
What Jeremy showed pretty clearly is that a piece of ice hitting the ocean that has a vertical cliff where that ice is about 1,000 meters thick and has about 100 meters high ice cliff sticking above the ocean should be structurally unstable. And that's about the limit that you see in the natural world. So I think a light bulb went off for Dave actually at that meeting where I said, okay, meltwater, 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 but this doesn't seem to be working. And Dave, thinking about Richard Alley, heard him talking about these ice cliffs, sitting in literally the bar of the hotel that I was staying in. I think Dave was drinking a beer and I was drinking a glass of Gruner Veltliner. Dave said, maybe there's something to these cliffs. It turned out that we needed both. The surface meltwater, that I had been so sort of focused on and trying to think of a way that could have been the answer to our prayers. Once we accounted for the impact of surface meltwater on not so much the lubrication of the ice sheet itself, but on the breakup of ice shelves, that meant that any time in our model where it got warm enough to have a lot of meltwater, we started to account for what that meltwater might do if it got into crevasses, like on ice shelves. And so for the first time, we started to simulate the sorts of events that we've seen happen in the past, like the breakup of the Larsen B ice shelf in 2002, where we saw ponded water on the surface of the ice shelf that was getting into crevasses, and the ice shelf broke up really dramatically. We put those physics in the model, and still, sure, that made the ice shelves go away, but we still weren't getting these really big sea level changes. But what it did was, once we let the ice shelves be impacted by the effects of meltwater, hydrofracturing, that started to produce ice cliffs around many different outlets around the Antarctic margin, not just out on the Antarctic Peninsula, but in a warmer world, ice cliffs started to crop up in the model in many places around the continent.
Just organically, you weren't parameterizing this. They just appeared as a result of the hydrofracturing from the increased surface melt.
Yes, and so we had to make some changes to the model to sort of diagnose where there would be an ice cliff. And really, literally, we almost didn't have to go any further. You could just look at a map to see where the ice cliffs were really tall. And all you had to do was basically to look at how deep the bed of the ice sheet was. So any place that was 800-900 meters a kilometer deep in terms of the bathymetry where the ice is hitting the ocean, but the ice has lost its protective ice shelf, you've got one of these ice cliff situations. So we just went to Jeremy's really nice, really elegant paper, and that provided a way for us to sort of scale places where in the model an ice cliff should be collapsing. Then the next challenge was, okay, well, how fast does that retreat happen? And, you know, this is where basically our work is headed now. So all we've been able to do so far, very simple and crude, look for some guidance from the real world. So we look at these systems like the Jakobshavn Glacier that I talked about in Crane and Helheim. We look to see the rate that ice is being lost in a scenario like that. And we can use those rates to generate and scale a simple parameterization for how an ice cliff margin might be retreating into the continent. This was really a nice little example of how our collaboration has gone over the years, where, you know, I had an idea that somehow that liquid meltwater on the surface is critical. Dave had, you know, an emerging idea that maybe ice cliffs are really important, but it turns out if you don't account for hydrofracturing in the model, you never get the ice cliffs. And if you don't account for the ice cliffs and their potential retreat and collapse, we would never have gotten the higher sea levels. You know, for the first time, we were able to simulate something that looks like a Pliocene ice sheet or a Miocene ice sheet or the ice sheet just during the last interglacial.
The success from that came out in a technical paper, I think, was it in Geology? And then paper in 2016, just a few months ago, in Nature, where you're running this combined modeling system constrained by estimates of sea level rise in the last interglacial and in the Pliocene warm period, and then running it through a range of emission scenarios, these representative concentration pathways, to show that over the next few hundred years, Antarctica could produce essentially no contribution to sea level rise or up to 20 meters of sea level rise. To me, that was been one of the most interesting examples of the power of mitigation. I think there's, at least for some questions or in some quarters, the idea that it's too late now. Why should we even be bothering trying to mitigate? But this is an amazing example of how much mitigation actually does matter.
So we've taken this to the level of not just crudely or roughly comparing what the models do relative to their performance in recreating past ice sheet changes, but we're actually using ensemble methods where we run many iterations of our model on a past scenario, and we end up with a subset of models that are successful in creating a series of past changes in the ice sheet. And the kinds of things that we look at are the maximum sea level that the model will produce during the Pliocene or during the last interglacial. In other ensemble studies, we look at the rate that the ice sheet retreats from its maximum extent during the last glacial maximum to today, make sure that it does something reasonable from the LGM to today. And that's a good test because we have some guidance on the rate that the ice sheet retreated through the Holocene. So we sort of combine all these different things, these different tests based on comparing with what the model does in recreating these past changes. And then what we end up with is a subset of different versions of the model that we can then apply to these future scenarios. It's quite striking. What we're finding now is that there are mitigation pathways, the more aggressive ones, where there is a very modest change in the ice sheet, if any. And in the more sort of business as usual scenarios with massive inputs of greenhouse gases over the next decades and centuries, we're getting a very dramatic retreat in the ice sheet. And that's, again, because of the appearance of meltwater on the surface of these ice shelves in these warmer scenarios. So it is an example. If the model is right, and we don't really know that it is yet, we have a lot to do in terms of testing the model, refining it, more comparisons against past records. But the way that it's looking right to us right now is that this is a beautiful example of the role that future mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions will play in really reducing a lot of risk in terms of the potential for really dramatic sea level rise in the future.
This paper had quite a bit of media attention when it came out. And I have a couple of questions on that. The first one is, do you have any advice for people who are dealing with media coverage of their own high-profile papers? And then secondly, was your experience that the media was interested in exploring this idea of the potential of mitigation, or did they just want to focus on the sort of the extreme high-end estimates that could come out of the model in a high-emission scenario?
I think that anyone in the media asked me about the potential for policy to play a role in reducing risk based on these results. I think in most, if not every interview that I gave, whether it was TV or radio, certainly mentioned that, but it wasn't anything. It's funny that I was asked directly. It was more, I think what struck most people was that if you were to take the results at face value, that it would imply almost a doubling of sort of the median worst case scenario for sea level rise that had been published in the most recent IPCC report. That was sort of the focus. You know, what I tried to do, and maybe I didn't do a good enough of a job, is to just reiterate the uncertainty in all of this. And I certainly still feel very strongly about the validity of this. The take-home message should be that having extensive surface meltwater on Antarctic ice shelves is probably a bad idea. You don't even really need to use a super sophisticated coupled climate ice sheet ocean model to say that. If you just look at to the example of what happened to the Larsen, and then the very simple notion that the last time that the Earth was maybe just a little bit warmer than it is today, the last interglacial period, about 125,000 years ago, there's now extensive evidence that sea level was between 6 and 9 meters higher than today. And the thinking on that now is that most of that didn't come from Greenland. So there's ice core evidence now, and the imaging of the Greenland ice sheet is telling us that the Greenland ice sheet was mostly intact at that time when sea level was 6 to 9 meters higher. So you have to look to Antarctica. Wow. So that means just simply that the system is really sensitive, and surface meltwater would be, you know, in its appearance would be one way of helping drive high sea levels. Although I will say that during the last interglacial period, based on the modeling work, those changes were probably mostly driven by warming of the ocean around Antarctica, but regardless. And then when you add in the effects of having surface meltwater in a climate that's even warmer than the last interglacial, more like the Pliocene, you get really dramatic and rapid retreat because of the combination of the hydrofracturing, losing ice shelves in many places in Antarctica, having very tall cliffs now exposed and they would mechanically fail and collapse, and it generated much more rapid potential rates of sea level rise than any of our previous work. Now, where I think the greatest uncertainty is lying for us, and of course, we're still doing a very crude job in terms of parameterizing like the rate of these ice cliff, retreating ice cliffs back into the Antarctic interior. We need to do a better job in representing those physics, and potentially down the road, we'd love not to have a crude parameterization, but really be trying to capture the physics of these collapsing ice cliffs, doing a better job with that. A lot of being able to say something about when this could potentially happen in a given future scenario has to do with when the liquid meltwater starts to appear in Antarctica.
Well, it's already there now.
It's already there now. As I understand, even last year, there were some pretty dramatic events on some of the big ice shelves that's days above freezing in the generation of liquid meltwater. So we want to keep those to a bare minimum based on what the physics in these models is telling us and what these lessons from the geologic past is telling us. The question as to when that might become so expansive in the future that it could trigger the kind of dramatic sea level rise that we simulated in some of these scenarios is a really difficult challenge, because the Antarctic climate system is so complex. It's confounded by the influence of the ozone hole over Antarctica, which is beginning to heal. That's going to have an influence on the trajectory of future warming. There are complex dynamical linkages between the local climate over Antarctica and even the tropics. So it's a very, very complex system. So even if we had the ice sheet physics down perfect, it would be still a challenge to say as to when this meltwater might really start to expand and when we might start to see that really big uptick in the rate of sea level rise. So, you know, I need to caution the press that the timing is still really, really uncertain. When that inflection point happens in those sea level curves that we published, we still have a lot of work to do on that. In fact, that'll be the focus of what I'll be talking about at AGU in San Francisco this year is how we're trying to get a better handle on that timing.
I'll be there.
Great.
Rob DeCanto from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst is working to bring physical understanding to climate models of the past, present, and the future. Rob, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Michael. I enjoyed it.
That was my interview with Rob DeCanto from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Listeners, hopefully your ears have stopped bleeding from the horrendous sound quality. Sorry about that. Otherwise, if you like the show, you can check out the show notes at forecastpod.org and leave comments there. You can also comment via iTunes. Comments there help the podcast to become more visible in searches for things like climate podcasts, so are always welcome. If you have suggestions about guests to have on the show, I'd love to hear about it. You can also check out the show on Stitcher and Google Play Music. The music for today's show is by my friend Carrie Kaufman. Carrie, many thanks. Couple of quick notes. First is that I mentioned a paper by Rons that I thought was in geology. It's actually in EPSL. And then in the interview, Rob discusses how his ideas on surface melt led initially to the basal lubrication idea. But we had a follow-up discussion on that, and the actual order of it was surface melt leading to hydrofracturing, and then that's still not producing enough melt. And then Rob adding in the basal lubrication at that point, which still didn't lead to enough surface melt, and thus the interest in the ice cliff fracturing mechanism. Talk to you soon.